On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I find that as a human being, very difficult to look at myself and say, what did I do to influence someone who, in my view, was and is an actual great and tremendous and magnificent spirit, you know? I pray and I ask God that what I did was live a principled life. I taught my son to like truth above all else.
That's Tupac Shakur's mother, Afeni Shakur, who died last night. We'll talk about her in just a bit. But first, prosecutors in one Arizona county have a new tactic in fighting the war against drug cartels. They're targeting teenagers. Drug cartels like to use minors to smuggle drugs because they're usually treated with leniency if they're caught. But now Cochise County prosecutors are charging these teens as adults. In the last year, 51 children have been charged as adults, the youngest was 14 years old. Joining me now to talk about this is Nigel Duara, national correspondent for the LA Times, reporting from Bisbee in Cochise County. Hi there.
Hey, Madeline, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, tell us about one of the young men in your story. His name is Mario Niebles, and he was 16 when he tried to smuggle marijuana into the United States. He was caught. What happened?
Sure. His story starts, he was working in a belt factory, a timing belt factory in Agua Prieta, Mexico. He was approached, like a lot of juveniles over there are, and told, you know, for just a little bit of your time, you can make a lot of money. And when you get caught, if you get caught, nothing bad is going to happen to you. And for years, that was true. Since 1973, at least, Cochise County has been telling the federal agents, if they ever bring them potential juvenile drug smugglers, say, look, if they're underage, we can't do anything with them. We really can't hold them. So you got to turn them back. But in the last year, what they've started doing is charging these juveniles as young as 14 with felony drug smuggling. So when he scaled the fence and ran over to pick up a bale of marijuana and was interdicted by a Border Patrol agent, he didn't expect anything to happen to him. And so he and many of the other individuals are surprised when, in fact, something does.
So usually Border Patrol would just hand these kids over to local prosecutors who would then release them?
It was actually apparently even more simple than that. The Border Patrol, knowing that these juvenile smuggling suspects were basically nothing was going to happen to them, they would just, as it was described to me, walk them back across the border to Naco and, you know, and obviously take the drugs.
Okay. So Cochise decided we're going to do something different. What made them change their minds after all these years?
Well, there's a new prosecutor. His name is Brian McIntyre. He was he worked some lower levels of the agency here. And then when he became the boss here, the district attorney, prosecutions overall spiked. They just started dealing with more cases. And one issue that the sheriff brought to him and said, hey, we can make a difference on this is with these juvenile offenders. And his, you know, what he says is not, the goal is not to just put people in prison. The goal is to change that sort of rumor that nothing will happen to the juvenile suspects if they are caught. He wants to the cartels and then, of course, the people across the border to know that things will indeed happen, that they can't be prosecuted now.
But this is just in one county, right?
Yes, it's a massive county. But yes, it's just one county here.
So the drug cartels could just send these minors across in a different place.
Yes, that's right. It's a more difficult crossing, and there are larger cities here, which makes it somewhat easier. If you're in Santa Cruz or in Yuma, it is more arid and more dangerous for everybody involved. So that's why this remains a popular route.
I see. Okay, so what happened to Mario Niebles?
So Mario Niebles was picked up by a Border Patrol agent and taken to the county sheriff's. They put him in a program or offered him a deal called Early Resolution Court. Basically, what that does is offers them the chance, if they take it, the plea deal, they will go to prison, a juvenile wing, essentially, of an adult prison for a year and a half, and then they will be deported. And that deal has been taken by almost every one of the juveniles that have to whom it's been offered. The exception is one other boy and Mario. Both of them said, you know, we don't want this deal. We want to be have our cases remanded to juvenile court.
And then, so were they tried in juvenile court?
So this is where we are right now, in at least in his story, is he is one of the first people, if not the first person, to ask to have the case remanded to juvenile court. And those arguments were just made on Friday. So we're still waiting to see what the judge will say and if this will become sort of a trend here, if this is going to be now the new sort of defense strategy going forward as far as these kids go.
Well, is it perfectly within the prosecutor's rights to charge these kids as adults?
Sure. In the statutes in Arizona, it says that, you know, 16 and older will be charged, essentially. And then 14 to 16 is at the prosecutor's discretion. They may be charged. So in all these cases, you know, there could be charges and they can. It is, as you said, at the prosecutor's discretion whether to charge them as adults.
So what is the defense arguing, that the crime doesn't fit the punishment?
The defense is arguing a couple things. They're saying, first of all, that this individual is just a cog in this machine, that the crimes that he committed, while they were adult in nature, were done with the mind of a kid, and a kid whose brain is not done developing, a kid who dropped out of school in the equivalent of our eighth grade, and somebody who basically is not capable of discerning right and wrong, as the old saying is. So that is where... that's where their argument comes in to try and push it back to juvenile court.
So the other 50 or so who were arrested and took the plea deal, they spent a year and a half in an adult prison?
Right. They spent a year and a half in, like I said, the juvenile wing of an adult prison, which comes, you know, with its own requirements. And the same thing while they're being held in jail before and after their deals go through. That means they have to be out of sight and out of sound of adult inmates. They have a different nutritional requirement. And the state has to educate them. And that's something I'm trying to report out a little bit now, is what is the nature of that education that they're mandated to receive.
So this could end up costing the county more money, prosecuting these kids as adults and sending them to the juvenile wing of the adult prison.
It is undoubtedly cost more money, because not only is it requiring, you know, more jail time and more shifts, but also the defense of these young men, and in some cases young women, has come largely from contract attorneys in town who charge $50-$60 an hour to take these cases. So it's already overwhelmed the defense bar here, which is, again, quite small in a small place like Bisbee, and it's already kind of spreading out into the contractors.
So this has been going on for the past year. Any sense that this has, in fact, dissuaded the drug cartels from using kids to smuggle drugs over the border there?
You know, we don't have reliable numbers at this point to look at, and to be honest, even if we did, it would take... a pretty narrow breakdown for me to be able to say conclusively one way or the other whether this has made an immediate impact. We'd have to know the age of smuggling suspects and then be able to say, for instance, we can extrapolate it out to all suspects. So even if we did that, I think it would be a couple of years before we would even start to be able to track that kind of a difference.
Okay, Nigel, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time.
That's Nigel Duara, national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, reporting from Bisbee, Arizona. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about this idea of charging minors as adults for drug trafficking? Do you think that's an effective way to fight drug smuggling? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Billions of dollars have been spent on border security, and still, migrants have been able to come across. Many are brought over by coyotes, human smugglers, who are paid thousands of dollars per migrant. About a decade ago, one coyote came up with a novel idea. He used bicycles to get people across. Bicycles could evade the sophisticated ground sensors on the American side. Over a period of about 3 years, some 7,000 bicycles were used to bring migrants to the U.S. The coyote mastermind was known as El Indio. He grew up in a poor village in Oaxaca and became a millionaire. His story is told by journalist Kimball Taylor in his new book, The Coyote's Bicycle. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you learn about these bicycles?
I was doing an environmental story on the border that had to do with thousands of car tires that wash across the Tijuana River from Mexico into the United States. And I was down there talking to a rancher about the car tires. The car tires, even though they're coming across the river from Mexico, they're actually Californians' tires. And we pay this fee for disposal and recycling, but apparently that's just the gas money to get them to Tijuana. The river brings them back for free. And eventually they end up on this land and in the ocean because the river empties into the ocean. And I was talking to him about the tires and the circularity there. And he said, you know what? It's just like the bicycles. And I said, what are you talking about, bicycles? And he said, come right over here. And we walked around his barn and he had a giant pile of bicycles. And he said that he had collected 1,000 bicycles in the last 6 months.
1,000?
Yeah.
And they were just abandoned on his land? Or near
his
land?
Over the valley. I said, where did they come from? And he pointed up the hill to Mexico and he said, they come from Mexico. This rancher was obsessed with collecting the bicycles, but I became obsessed in finding out where they had come from and where they were going.
So it turns out that most of them were American. They came from America to begin with. And it was part of an operation, trucking them into Mexico, part of a smuggling operation. And they weren't just trucked in to be trucked in.
No. The smugglers had figured out where to get the most bicycles at the cheapest price. And it turns out police auction is where you get the most bicycles. And so the smugglers themselves had this operation where they were going to police auctions across the Southwest from Albuquerque to Los Angeles and buying bicycles in bulk from police auction.
But this was the idea of one guy.
Yes.
You eventually find out. I mean, it took you a while to find this out, right?
Yeah. I walked into that pile of bicycles in the Tijuana River Valley, I had no idea. All I saw was a bunch of bikes.
So you eventually find out that it's one guy. His name is Pablo. Or
yeah.
El Indio. You found out about his childhood, how he grew up in Oaxaca, in a poor, small village. His parents left him to go to the United States to make some money and left him with his grandfather, who died shortly thereafter that. What was his childhood like?
Well, the 1990s in rural Mexico, 1980s and 1990s, was just desperate. There was one economic collapse after another and peso devaluation. And these villages in Oaxaca, which is very southern Mexico, they were living on subsistence. Even to have meat was an extreme luxury. And to go to school beyond elementary school was pretty much an extravagance. The government paid for school through elementary school, but then it was up to the families to pony up. And so many of them couldn't. And that's partially why many of the villages just emptied out of the men and other people who could work. They came to the United States.
And that's what happened to his parents and his brothers and sisters. They just left.
He had a grandfather that he just loved. And the parents got some remittances from siblings that were working in the United States. And the parents made the decision, okay, we're going to keep you here with your grandfather and we're going to pay for you to go to secondary school, which would be junior high to us. And we're going to go to California and we're going to find your siblings and we're going to work with them. And if things work out, then we'll send for you. If they don't work out, then we'll return home. Well, in the interim, they lost communication. They never sent for El Indio. His grandfather ended up dying and there was nothing left in the village for him. And he made the decision at a young age to go to Tijuana and figure out a way to cross the border to meet with his parents.
But he doesn't do that.
No, it turned out that when he got to the border, he did what many migrants do. They end up just walking the borderline looking for an opportunity. And he did that for some time. And he actually linked up with some coyotes that were willing to cross him. But at one point, one instance, they were robbed and turned back. Another point, the border patrol turned them back. He fell in with some bad coyotes, so he was kept being rebuffed back into Mexico. And in that time, he started to see the business in crossing people, which is something that very rare in migrants. You know, people want to cross to work in the United States, but he saw this opportunity to make money there on the border. He studied how the Border Patrol works, and he studied their shift changes and their routes, and he timed how long it might take a Border Patrol vehicle to get from the top of a mesa to the bottom of a mesa. And he came up with this plan of using bicycles, which seems pretty ridiculous. I mean, we're talking about one of the most technologically fortified 5 miles of our 2,000-mile border. Every technology you could think of or that the Border Patrol is brought to bear there, from laser tripwires to seismic sensors. So it seems like a simple idea, but he had a very cunning method.
Can you describe the process of actually crossing the border on a bicycle? How does it work?
Well, the border has 18,000 some odd seismic sensors in the ground. And seismic, you can imagine, they detect earthquakes, thumping, running, pounding things. And traditionally, that's how migrants traveled. They ran, they hiked, they walked, whereas Border Patrol rolled. And so you can see how the bicycles would flip the trend. Suddenly the migrants are rolling and the seismic sensors aren't picking up the pounding. As I mentioned before, he was recruiting migrants to, they call sell. They literally sell the migrants to the coyote. And he was doing that. So once he figured out how to get bicycles across, he brought migrants he recruited on the bicycles. And so much of it is bluff and bluster. But in this instance, it worked well enough to get thousands of migrants across.
Thousands in a period of 3 years. They paid $4,500 apiece.
Yeah.
So how much money did he make?
I know how much money they grossed, roughly $28 million. But everyone along the way was paid. The police, the Tijuana police were paid. All the people in the hierarchy of the smuggling operation were paid. The people who went to the United States to gather the bicycles, they were paid. Mexican customs agents who allowed the bicycles in without duties, they were paid. So everyone made money along the chain. But he walked away as a millionaire. I mean, he arrived to Tijuana with just enough money to eat in his pocket. And he now lives in the United States as a millionaire.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Kimball Taylor, the author of a new book called The Coyote's Bicycle. You weren't able to actually meet him, were you?
No. Well, I had intermediaries, and I was told that he was present at various times because...
What do you mean?
Watching me, checking me out, all this.
But you didn't see him. He was just watching
you.
Yeah.
So it's this odd experience of, you know, knowing the intimate details of his story and being told that he was present, but I haven't met him, no.
Did you ever think that maybe he didn't exist, that someone was telling you just a fable, a story?
Yes. Yeah. You know, along the borderlands, a story that's not worth embellishing just isn't worth telling. So there was a lot of trust issues between me and the sources. And I spent 4 years digging into this to a point where, I mean, I knew it to be true. And it was just a matter of corroborating all of the things that I really did know. And bringing them full circle.
Were you ever afraid? This trade in human beings is controlled by gangs, illegal forces, traffickers who aren't afraid to, you know, kill other people if they get in their way.
Yeah, but I think I had a couple things going for me. And one is that the quality of bicycles, people love bicycles, you know. If I had been looking into drug tunnels, it would have ended before I started. But people love bicycles. And I talked to migrants who crossed on bicycles and they'd slap their leg and they'd say, that's like drugs. I love it. One guy I talked to, he almost didn't cross because he felt the bike he got to cross was so nice. Maybe he should just stay and keep the bicycle. People have this affinity for bicycles so that the people involved in the smuggling enterprise, they thought it was fun. They thought it was funny and they felt it was a trick of the authorities so that they almost couldn't keep it in. That was definitely something that I had going for me. And I also happened to meet someone that had entree to El Indio and his family. And his name is El Negro. And he just happened to have a love for a story, you know, and he became a close associate. and helped me navigate this world.
So you know for a fact that El Indio lives here in the United States?
Yes.
But he's given up the smuggling? He's retired?
You know what's so interesting about people in Tijuana and Mexico who made money at that time is they would do something that a new millionaire in the United States would never do, and that is get a regular job. I find it so interesting that he works a day job.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, he owns a landscaping business.
So what did U.S. Border Patrol do about this bicycle migration, these 7,000 bicycles? There must have been dozens of bicycle crossings a day.
You know, bikes are so interesting because they're not only are the thing that you desire to steal, they're the vehicle that you're going to whisk it away with, too. So bikes just wheeled out of the valley in so many anonymous ways and back into American society that they were kind of liquid-like in their sprawl. And so even though that there was piles of bikes at various locations, there were so many more that just were absorbed into the city.
It's so interesting to think of the origins and how they ended up. Bicycles made perhaps in China, shipped over here to the United States, bought new, somehow lost or stolen or sold, and making their way across the border to Mexico. Yeah, rode on by a migrant back to the United States.
The ability of bicycles to move through all of these worlds is what really first attracted me. I hadn't yet known about the story of El Indio and his rags to riches story and the tragedy at the heart of his story. But in terms of how the bikes move, I started to think about value and how something doesn't have value until someone wants that thing and the degree to which they want it. And one illustration might be this Free Spirit bicycle that I have. It was a brand made by Sears, and this one just happened to be made in Taiwan. They've been made all over the world, but this one was made in Taiwan. It was sold in the Midwest for $69, and somehow it made it to Los Angeles, and it got caught up with the LAPD somehow, and they sold it at auction to El Indio's gang. They took it to Tijuana. It crosses the border, and suddenly it's a $4,500 bicycle because that was the fee that the smugglers used to cross a person with it, right? Well, once that migrant crossed, they would just dump the bicycle, and the rancher who picked that bicycle up, well, it was free to him, and he would turn around and sell them at the swap meet for $20. Just the degree with which its actual price fluctuates did just amaze me.
So El Indio, he settles in the United States and is now a landscaper. Did he ever see his family again?
Oh, yeah. His family works for him.
Oh, such a happy ending.
Well, you know, there's so many sad stories on the border that sometimes I struggled with the fun of the bicycle aspect of it. You know, El Indio did reunite with his family and he did meet his goals, but he lost a wife and a son in the process. So it's not all happy ending.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kimball Taylor, author of The Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and the Rise of a Borderland Empire. Coming up, Tupac Shakur's mother, Afeni Shakur Davis, has died. How she kept her son's music alive after he was murdered. That story is next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me. But I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef. 17 years old, kicked out on the streets.
Tupac Shakur's song Dear Mama, it features and pays tribute to his mother, Afeni Shakur, who died last night at her home in Sausalito, California. She was 69 years old. Afeni Shakur was an activist, a former member of the Black Panthers, and a protective mother who took control of her son's estate and oversaw his legacy after he died in 1996 at the age of 25. Kevin Powell knew Afeni and Tupac well. He's the author of the new book, The Education of Kevin Powell, A Boy's Journey into Manhood, and also a forthcoming biography of Tupac Shakur. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you.
Well, thanks for being here. Now, she never stopped making sure her son was remembered publicly, and he was popped up on Kendrick Lamar's album, To Pimp a Butterfly. He was a hologram at Coachella. There was a Broadway musical in 2014. Was that her life's calling in the last 20 years, preserving her son's legacy?
Well, I think it's a part of it. You know, when I was at Vibe magazine doing all those interviews with Tupac Shakur, the first time I interviewed him, I knew I had to interview Afeni as well, because as a writer and activist, I certainly knew the Shakur name and knew her history, and obviously the history of the Black Panther Party. She's a legend. She was a legend in our community, which she represented. And, you know, for me and for a lot of us, Tupac's work was just an extension of the activism work in a lot of ways that Afeni was about with her own life. And she certainly was thrust into the role of having to be the protector of his work when he died nearly 20 years ago this September, tragically. And, you know, you talk about the putting the music out, the resurrection film that was nominated for Academy Award about a dozen years ago, all of those different things. And people need to understand that Tupac Shakur, thanks to his mother and thanks to so many other people, is the global hip-hop icon ever, the most important one around the world. You can go to any country in the world and you'll see Tupac's name and work mentioned in some way, and Afeni Shakur is certainly as well-known, which is why you see so much sadness all over social media today.
Well, how much of that legacy of him, as you say, being a worldwide icon today, how much is that because of her?
Oh, she gave birth to him. There would be no Tupac. I mean, because you're talking about the son of a Black Panther, someone who's a product of the civil rights movement, someone who grew up in a legacy of struggle and movement and a lot of the things that you all talk about at NPR. And so in a lot of ways, you can't separate Tupac from his mother. I remember when I did an exclusive interview with Tupac when he was first put in jail at Rikers Island. The song Dear Mama came out, and to me that's probably one of the most important songs ever made about a relationship between a mother and a son. And that song captures, as you just played it, the essence of the relationship. It's inseparable, and it's a sad day for a lot of us that she passed. I was very been up since early this morning when I first heard the news from folks.
Yeah. So she, in that song, Dear Mama, she talks about, she's in the song, as we just heard, about being in jail and pregnant with Tupac. And she was in jail after being convicted for firebombing incidents as a member of the Black Panther Party. Later, those charges were dropped.
Yeah, they were exonerated. Those charges were dropped. But we have to understand, during that time, which has been documented in the film Panthers by Stanley Nelson, also the great documentary Eyes on the Prize, there were many attacks on civil rights folks, including Dr. King, and Afeni Shakur was certainly caught up in that. One of the things I remember about Afeni when I interviewed her, she said she was a young woman in North Carolina watching the civil rights movement on TV, and she moved north because she wanted to get involved. And that's how it all happened for her. Little did she know that she would be involved in the movement, she would get pregnant, be arrested, and literally a month before Tupac Shakur was born in June 1971, she was still in jail. And so her story is a heroic story for a lot of people. Then being a single mother, surviving the crack addiction, moving around the country with Tupac and her daughter, Setua, and just all the things that she was able to do in her lifetime, and then literally watching your son, you know, getting killed and having to be a protector of that estate. I mean, it to me, it shows what kind of extraordinary human being she was and how powerful, as you know, Ms. Perrin, women are the real leaders on this planet, and Afeni Shakur represented, you know, so many different types of women.
Okay, I want to play a clip of tape of her talking to NPR 10 years after her son's murder about his work and his legacy.
To see a young person, especially in his generation, especially at the time, be able to reach so honestly towards his own humanity, good and bad, positive and negative, I think that that's what it is that ultimately affects people.
So, as I said earlier, she made it her life's work in the last 20 years to uphold that legacy. She even sued Death Row Records. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, Death Row Records went into bankruptcy, as you know, it's documented, and it seems that that still was lingering. And, you know, it's just something that happens with a lot of artists. We see it now happening with Prince, with the what's going to happen with his music. She's been in the battle with them. You know, that music belongs to Tupac. He was a prolific artist in a way that a lot of artists have not been in the hip-hop world, and there are folks who want to continue to capitalize off of him, and we believe, you know, that all of that should be going to the estate. The estate should control all of that, and that's what Fane Shakur was fighting for, you know, her and Molly and Tom Wally and the folks that are there now. You know, that's you know, the estate should have that. That should belong to the family and the folks who run the estate, and, you know, Tupac made that label really pop in a certain kind of way when he came out of jail. He sold a ton of records, one of the first hip-hop artists to put out a double album on Death Row Records. And so the hope is that even though she's gone, that will be resolved, and hopefully that will go to the estate, and also that everything that's supposed to belong to Tupac Shakur and his legacy will be handled properly. That's my hope as a writer and observer of this and someone who's documented Tupac for years.
So that lawsuit is still ongoing?
Yeah, as you were talking, I just got a text from someone saying that's still lingering. So hopefully that will be resolved. And I know there was a bankruptcy case with Bank Death Row Records, but, you know, for me, what I hope that people remember is that, you know, there would not have been a Tupac Shakur if there had been no Fane Shakur. You know, that's the most important thing to me right now. And just to die just before Mother's Day, and, you know, and this is the anniversary, the 20th anniversary year of Pac passing. It's just, you know, that's where my heart is now. That's where my thoughts are. You know, all the legal stuff and what will happen with this music. And, you know, I do believe that the folks that are in place now will make sure that it's taken care of properly. I hope so.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kevin Powell. He's the author of the new book, The Education of Kevin Powell, A Boy's Journey into Manhood, and a forthcoming biography of Tupac Shakur. Coming up on the program, the State Department has created a new position to deal exclusively with gay and trans issues abroad. In many countries, it's lethal to be outspoken about LGBT issues.
We don't have to look any further than the case of this young Bangladeshi activist who was killed by extremists just a few days ago.
Randy Berry is here. He talks about his new job. We'll have that story next on Press.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app and get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Gay marriage is legal here in the United States and in 21 other countries, including many European countries, along with possibly unlikely places like Brazil, Argentina, and South Africa. But the rest of Africa and huge parts of Asia and Latin America not only don't recognize gay marriage, gay rights are under attack. In the last few years, thousands of LGBT people have been injured, hundreds have been killed. Last year, the State Department created a new position, Special Envoy for Human Rights of LGBTI Persons. And the first person to fill that position is Randy Berry, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Well, first, the I in that title. Stands for?
The I stands for intersex, and this is a fairly recent innovation for us as well, that when I came on seat just barely over a year ago, we were still defining our policy space as LGBT. There's a fairly broad definition of intersex individuals, but principally we're talking about people who are gender nonconforming, mm-hmm. Or who have been born without an explicit or clear indication as to gender, and what happens then in particularly within the medical field, to deal with this as a medical issue rather than an issue of identity, which obviously is problematic in some ways.
Why did the State Department feel the need to create this special position? Isn't this the work of all diplomats to work for the human rights of everyone under the U.S.'s idea of basic human rights abroad?
I look at this innovation, the evolution of the special envoy position very much as simply a tool. This is the first time we have centralized as a portfolio this issue with a single individual who can travel extensively, who can engage at senior levels within host governments. So it's all about elevating the conversation.
And which countries are you most focused on right now?
Over this last year, I've traveled in 42 countries in every single region of the world. You, in your introduction, mentioned some of the surprising places of leadership that we've seen, and this is something I'm really interested in harnessing. Is, you know, we normally look to Northern Europe for the model of LGBT and diversity inclusion, and that is still very much true. I mean, countries like Sweden or the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway have been well ahead of the U.S., certainly well ahead of the global norm in terms of defining the space. But what I have discovered is that, in fact, some of the most recent and exciting innovation is coming from Argentina. It's coming from Chile. It's coming from Uruguay and Brazil and Colombia. These are the countries who have been moving human rights resolutions, for example, at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, that we've been perfectly happy to support, and there's no reason for the U.S. to get in front of those things. But we're seeing leadership from the global south now emerge in a really interesting way.
Conversely, we're seeing a lot of negative stories coming out of places like Africa, Uganda primarily, and other places where Islamists and Islamism is on the rise. Are you focused on that? And that's a very delicate diplomatic chore for you, I'm sure, is trying to talk to the leaders of these countries.
In most cases, I think it's possible still to have a rational, constructive conversation about moving the ball forward. Not making leaps and bounds that I think are unrealistic, but taking a look at an individual context, as is the case in Uganda, and understanding what would a step forward look like in that context, and bank that, and then take the next step forward. So when I traveled in Uganda, for example, I was met at a very senior level. I met with the prime minister of the country and had a very rational conversation about the basic human rights and economic implications for the law that was being had been reviewed there.
And what was the result of that conversation?
Well, I think that there's a very clear understanding of the equities that are at stake. Oftentimes, you have politicians who, I think, are quite willing to exploit negative attitudes about this to distract from other things. For example, in a place like Russia, I believe that this is merely a populist tool that deflects from other quite legitimate areas of discussion. Mm. But because social acceptance is so low, it's seen as a fairly low-hanging fruit to gin up a voter base. So I think that it's not as simple as simply changing a law, that then you have to allow civil society to do its work, to make sure people understand what it means to be a member of this community, to make sure they understand what the basic issues are that are involved. Because, you know, out of all the travels I've done, probably the clearest takeaway that I get is that our principal challenge, globally speaking, is simply ignorance, that people don't know what they're talking about, because the level of visibility in so many countries is so low that there is a perception of what it means to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex. And because there's that lack of information, people tend to fill in those gaps with very frightening ideas and connotations, and they allow fear to define the social and political space. I think that's a tragedy.
Can you give me an example of a conversation that you've had with someone where you were taken aback by the level of ignorance or misunderstanding?
I think early on in my tenure, I realized that you have to start at such a basic level to make sure that people understand that we are talking about an issue of identity, not an issue of behavior. In so many places around the world where you have a very low level of acceptance, there is a belief that this is simply a chosen behavior that someone decides to exhibit.
Well, many people in this country believe that.
Indeed. But I think what the data shows us is that what has really changed the hearts and minds of people here in the U.S., where we've seen this massive change, certainly over the span of my life, has been the element of visibility. and personal knowledge. That changes everything when you can take this from being a theoretical discussion into something that has a human face and has a life and a story attached to it. I think that is what ultimately has produced so much change here in the U.S.
Do you speak personally about your life when you meet with these officials? Do you say, I'm a gay man? And this is my story?
I take a different approach each time. Where I think we have extremely low levels of social acceptance, yes, I do make sure that that is worked into the conversation, simply because I believe that it helps to chip away at mistaken impressions about what being a member of the LGBTI community is.
So are they ever taken aback when they meet you?
I have had individuals before following a meeting when I have made a comment about my husband or about the children that we are raising together, to have people approach me and say, it didn't occur to me that you might be gay. But it still, it provides such a jolt to understanding what it is we're talking about here. We're talking about individuals who, given the same equality of opportunity, the same equality of access to education, housing, healthcare, all the things that we build our lives upon, can play absolutely any role in society, that it's because of the discrimination that they end up marginalized. And what I find, though, is that is no substitute for someone in a local context for the first time standing up saying, I am gay or lesbian or transgender. I am also a citizen of this country, and all I'm asking for is to be treated equally. That act requires an extreme level of bravery, an extreme commitment. I also don't think that there's any substitute for it. But there is an active understanding, I think, in most cases about just how difficult that's going to be. We don't have to look any further than the case of this young Bangladeshi activist who was killed by extremists just a few days ago, as evidence of that. You have the first person in a society taking that brave step, and it's not always done without risk. In fact, it's rarely done without substantial risk. But I would say, also an important part of this is that we are behaving and engaging in such a way that is helpful for civil society actors on the ground. Because I firmly believe that the only way that real change occurs in a country is when it is indigenous, and that comes through the efforts of very brave men and women who are active and undertaking all of these broader issues that I've mentioned. Change isn't going to come because the U.S. government says it should come. I'm a veteran of the State Department, the State Department's Foreign Service Officer Corps, for the last 24 years. I've lived most of my life overseas, including in a number of jurisdictions that are pretty tough right now. I lived in Bangladesh. I've lived in Egypt. I lived in Uganda. And I think it is a different thing to be a gay foreigner than to be a gay local.
Were you out in those countries?
I was professionally out in those countries, yes. But also with the fact of being there under diplomatic posting, the fact that you simply, that one of the goals as a diplomat is to try to figure out the local environment, to integrate, to help your own understanding, so you can interpret U.S. policy for local populations and governments, and also so you can take a look at political trends and social trends and analyze them back. But I think despite that if you're not from a place, it's much harder to influence that. That there is certainly a difference in how that plays out. But I do believe it's a start.
Well, Arun, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's Randy Berry. He's the State Department's first ever special envoy for the human rights of LGBTI persons. Coming up on this program, something a little lighter. Catherine Spires, our food expert, is here to talk about new summer drinks. That's next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Summer is coming, and with it, summer parties, meaning eating, drinking in the sun. We're going to focus on the drinking part of that with Catherine Spires, food writer and host of the podcast, How It Got in Your Mouth, and she's here now with her summer drinking guide. Hi.
Hi.
And no drinks, I just might add. You came drinkless.
Yeah, right. This All time.
Right. So you've been talking to local beer and wine sellers, and what are they hawking? What are the must-drink beers of the season?
So in terms of local breweries, there's one called Cismontane, and they have a Cali IPA and a lager called Citizen. And IPAs and lagers are two of the types of beers that you want to be drinking over the summer. Mm-hmm. There's also a local brewery called Smog City, and they have one called Little Bow Pils. Pilsner, right? Yeah, it's a little mm-hmm. cute.
There are a lot of local breweries now popping up.
Yeah, in the past 10 years or so, it's just become this like micro economy of beer. We were actually late to the game on that one. LA usually leads the charge, but other cities had it first, but now we are embracing it fully.
Okay, so wines, rosé, obviously people like to drink that.
Yes, yeah. And there's some nice local rosés, including some from regions you might not expect. San Diego.
Really?
Yeah. Vesper Vineyards is down there, and they've got a couple really good rosés. There's another one in San Diego called Los Pilares, and they actually are making a sparkling musket. And
what is a musket?
It's a type of wine that isn't usually like a dinner wine. It's a little bit sweeter. But they make it in this pre-industrial rustic French style called Pet Nat, and that is where it actually ferments in the bottle. So The flavor might be a little bit bolder, stronger, or it might be something totally unexpected because it ferments in the bottle, so they don't know
like
what the end result is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Does it have that kind of sour taste?
It might. It might, because who knows what happens in the fermentation. So that's another one that might be a little bit interesting to try. And then, of course, up in Santa Barbara County, there's some good wineries there. There's Riverbench. They make a nice rosé. And if you want to spend a little more money, there's Blair Fox Cellars, which has a couple white wines that are really good for summer. They have a Vermentino and a Viognier called Paradise Road that are both good for like lighter, more summertime meals. They pair well with fruits and vegetables and whatnot.
Then there's sparkling wine and champagne, also nice to drink in the summertime.
Those
are
two.
Anytime, really.
Yeah, absolutely, anytime. And it was surprising to me to learn that some people don't quite know the difference between sparkling wine and champagne. The easiest answer is if it's champagne, it has to have come from the Champagne region of France.
Right.
Everything else is just sparkling wine.
What about Prosecco?
Prosecco is sparkling wine. Yeah.
From Prosecco.
Yes.
In Italy.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. But do you have to capitalize champagne when you write it?
I know that some wineries that aren't from Champagne will say they've made champagne and put it in lowercase and say that that's okay. They've done their due diligence. I don't know if there's an official ruling from France on that one.
If anyone would have an official ruling on that, it would be France.
It would be, yeah.
For sure. Okay, so what about storage? So in the summer, you're taking drinks in and out of the refrigerator. Can you do that with wine, or does it make it go bad quicker?
So for wine, that's totally okay. Not the same issue that you might have with beer, because with beer, the issue comes from hops, which of course wine doesn't have. So with wine, you can put it in the fridge, take it out of the fridge, bring it back. The only issue you ever have is if wine is repeatedly subjected to a high temperature often. But it would have to be a lot. A lot of times kitchens are built with a wine rack over the stove. You don't want that because then you're essentially cooking your wine and turning it into sort of a stewed fruit
flavor. I've never seen that.
Yeah.
So you should store your red wine in a cool, dark place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ideally. But you're not really going to ruin wine if you're just like, you know, if you take it to someone's house and then you end up bringing it back. No big deal. Not a problem at all. Beer, on the other hand, beer you actually have to be a lot more careful about because beer can skunk. And that's just the term for it going bad.
So it kind of smells and tastes like a skunk.
Yeah, actually the process, the breakdown process of skunking, it releases the sulfuric odor that actually smells like skunk smell.
So what causes that?
Well, a lot of people think that it is a change in temperature. And if you have chilled beer and then you take it out of the fridge and then you put it back in the fridge, people are like, well, you've ruined it.
Even if it's not open.
Right. But it's actually not a temperature issue, it's a light issue. You can't expose beer to too much light because that'll make it go bad. So a lot of people in the early days of importing bottled beer to America from Europe thought that European beer just had like a very strong, aggressive, unpleasant taste to it. And it's actually that the beer was shipped over in green bottles and had skunked on the way over. Yeah. So that's why beer in brown bottles is a better choice. And even though bottled beer sort of has the more upmarket association, the safest way to keep your beer is in a can.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't you get the taste of the aluminum?
I mean, if you have a very sensitive palate, that might happen. But in terms of skunking, your best bet is having it from a can or a dark brown bottle.
Well, what about a beer like Corona, which is in a see-through bottle?
It is. It is in a clear bottle. And I, of course, can't get confirmation from Corona, but a lot of people say the sort of story about Corona is that the reason they promoted the idea of putting a lime in it is because it masks the taste of skunked beer.
Well, why don't they just make it in brown bottles?
I don't know. I think that all the beers have their brand identity so strongly ingrained that they just don't want to change anything.
Right. Well, happy summer, happy partying, happy drinking.
Absolutely. All of that.
Catherine Spires, food writer and host of the podcast, How It Got in Your Mouth. And Julie Myers is here now wearing her producer hat, as you normally do.
That's right.
But you also have a beer hat.
I do.
Not one of those hats that you drink from, hopefully. But you're a beer expert.
No, because drinking beer out of a straw is an abomination. That is something, never shall that be done. Okay? That's a beer commandment. No drinking beer
I'm
going to
follow
straw.
That commandment.
That's right. Thank you.
What is your favorite summer beer?
Ooh. Catherine mentioned Little Bo Pils from Smog City. Absolutely delicious, refreshing, light, perfect summer beer. There's also a beer called Hello LA IPA. It's in a can, which she mentioned, and that's from Highland Park Brewery, which is one of my very favorite breweries in the entire city. They make such amazing beer, and that is just a very refreshing IPA. It's Cinco de Mayo this week, and you don't have to drink Corona on Cinco de Mayo or Pacifico in those clear bottles. Nobody wants that. As we just heard, there's a couple Mexican microbreweries that you should try out. Baja Brewing Company, they have something called Cabotea, which is sold here, and that's like a Mexican lager, only it's a lot better. And then there's Cervecería Insurgente, which is based in Tijuana, and they have an IPA and a I think it's a wit beer, and those are both absolutely delicious as
Do you get those here?
So there's any of your finer bottle shops. Whole Foods has a great beer selection.
Okay.
But there's bottle shops all over the city. Sunset Beer, always a good place to check.
Great. Well, thanks for those tips.
You're so welcome.
Okay, now back to work. That's Julie Myers, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.